G'day, beloved listeners. I'm in the National Capital today. I've just had a very strange experience. I gave a speech of sorts to a very large hall, absolutely jam-packed with people in uniform, all training to be officers in the Navy, the Air Force, or the Army. They seem to be there in their thousands. And then afterwards I had dinner in the officers' mess, would you believe, with rear admirals and major generals. Everyone clapped, but then quite clearly they were under orders to do so, and had they not applauded, they would have got court-martialed. I don't think I've ever had an odder encounter with a more dramatically different audience. We return, dear listener, to the economic meltdown of 2008. I've lost count, as indeed you have, on the number of programmes we've done on the GFC over the years, during and after. And here we are teetering on the brink of another one. So a good time to return to the subject, to pull it apart yet again. We'll be discussing whether or not it was the outcome of individual greed. One of my panellists is Jeff Madrick, the editor of Challenge magazine and visiting professor of humanities at the Cooper Union, and he traces the lineage of some of America's most pressing economic problems in his new book titled Age of Greed. Author Yanis Varoufakis, meanwhile, contests that argument that ineffectual regulation of banks, greed and globalization were the root causes. Quote, rather they are the symptoms of a much deeper malaise, which can be traced back to the Great Crash of 29. He writes in his new book, The Global Minotaur, and Oliver Hartwich, Research Fellow in the Economics Program at the Centre for Independent Studies here in Sydney, writes in a recent article that the world is facing crisis fatigue. Well, you've got that right, Oliver. Certainly this ageing presenter is fatigued by decades of crises. He sums this up as a psychological consequence which has come about because of the economic turmoil. Quote, with all the simultaneous crisis events happening, it's difficult to really make sense of it all. There are too many trees and not enough wood. Many commentators are getting confused about the root causes. There's another arboreal reference. The root causes of the economic difficulty we're in. So let's dedicate the entire program today to root out the root causes of the economic crisis. And hopefully by the end of it, not only will we have greater clarity, but we'll have solved the problem and the planet will be exceedingly grateful. Oliver Hartwich is in our Sydney studio. Yanis Varoufakis joins us on the blower from Dublin, where he's fortunate to be attending a conference. And Jeff Madrick is on the line from Washington, D.C. Jeff, your book triggered this discussion, so let's start with you. You write that the rise of an age of greed since the 70s was not the result of inevitable forces of history or a natural swing of a political pendulum. The new age was made by people and how they reacted to crisis and change, much damage done along the way. Greed, the root cause?
Well, I think greed became the major cause over the years. I believe in self-interest as a motivating force in capitalism. I believe it must be tempered by serious regulation. But self-interest expanded into something I would call greed. I don't do a philosophical disquisition on greed. But it is very apparent that individuals, particularly in the financial community, could make a lot of money doing not what they were supposed to do, which was to channel capital to productive investments. But in effect, and I don't want to be casual about this because this is a serious statement, but to play money games with each other, violate the rules consistently, make a lot of money, and soon finance was dominating the American economy. It was once true that finance worked for business, that Wall Street worked for business to raise money, to maintain cash, and so forth. It switched. Eventually, business started working for Wall Street because CEOs and other executives were compensated based on stock prices. And the stock market went from one fashion to another. We had crisis after crisis since the 1970s. We claimed it did not affect us. and yet finally it exploded in 2007, 2008, unambiguously. But the problems began much sooner.
Jeff, your view, of course, was echoed by Oliver Stone very famously in the Wall Street movie with the absolutely resonating phrase, greed is good. And for a while there, it was morally and ethically justified, wasn't it?
I think, you know, somebody asked me the other day, has greed become patriotic in America? I was a little bit taken back. It sounded so, it sounded so odd, but I suppose some people do think, you know, that phrase, greed is good, was based on something the arbitrageur and inside information trader Ivan Boesky said to a graduating class in the U.S. I think he said greed is healthy. I do discuss Ivan Boesky in the book, and I did know him as a journalist way back then. But I do think something happened that tolerated this. I read in one respectable newspaper after another how these people who are making 5, 10, 25, and occasional hedge fund managers $1 billion a year really deserved it, number one, because they were brilliant, number two, because somehow they were making a contribution to the economy equivalent to which justified their very large compensation.
Jeff, in our country, in my country, to which you're broadcasting at the moment, the highest life form is regarded as the sporting hero. And if we have a national religion, it probably is sport. But your greed is gooders were admired in the much the same way for a while, weren't they?
I think so. We admire our sports figures also. And by the way, congratulations on Samantha Stosur. I watched the match on TV, and she played brilliantly. But I think they were very widely admired. I think young people wanted to emulate them. I think there was a fantasy that not that they weren't intelligent, they were, but that they made money in extraordinarily intelligent ways. In fact, many of them made money by borrowing and simply investing somewhere else. And I hope it will come out over the years about whether and to what degree they manipulated and front ran their clients and so forth to make money.
Oliver, I want to bring you in now, and it's your responsibility to remind us all that greed goes all the way back to antiquity. In fact, I think it gets a few mentions in the good book, doesn't it?
Well, it does, actually. I think it helps to read the Bible, whether you're religious or not, but it is a good reminder. If you're reading the Old Testament, there are numerous occasions where greed is mentioned in the Old Testament, so it seems to be a vice that really goes back thousands of years. It's a defining feature of humanity. We have always been greedy, and you may not like it, but it is always around. And the real challenge...
And some people way back then actually coveted thy neighbor's ass, didn't they?
Well, yeah. The thing is, actually, it is really going back thousands of years. It seems to be one of the defining features of the human race. The real challenge is how to deal with greed and how to actually come up with a system in which greed is channeled, in which greed is framed, and where you still have liability rules, for example.
I'd like now to bring Yannis in because he comes from a great classical culture and has got a rather different view. It's not so much biblical as mythical. You talk, of course, about the great crash of 29, Yannis, and then go on through the 70s when what you describe as a global minotaur was born.
Not quite right, Philip. Look, I don't believe in inevitable forces of history either. And I think that individuals play, well, they fashion history. But I don't think we should be stuck in between those two alternatives. What happened, I think, in the last 100 years is that we had two catastrophic moments in history. 1929 was one, and 2008 was the other. And in between, we had two game changers. One came in the 1940s when the United States took the gallant role of shaping the world economy in its image and effected a quite rational global plan of astonishing ambition and very successfully. And then the other date, of course, 1971, when that global plan collapsed and gave rise to an era which I call the era of the global minotaur. It's just a metaphor that I use in order to make sense of what's happening to us.
But it's a good metaphor, Yanis. Explain it, tease it out for the listener.
Well, let's start from ancient mythology, a pre-tragedy era, when people told myths to one another in order to make sense of the world, of a very simple world. But nevertheless, let's not forget that the period when the Minoans reigned in the Eastern Mediterranean was a period when we have effectively the first globalization in economic terms, not just in terms of the movement of populations, in the sense that Crete was the great power and it imposed its iron will on the remaining Greek, or what we call now Greek city-states. The result was a Pax Cretana, which enabled a boisterous trade to occur between the Greek cities, Crete, the Phoenicians, Egypt. So, and the way that the ancients tried to make sense of this was by creating this myth of that sad and lonely beast that lived in the labyrinths, in the guts of King Minos's palace, which needed to be fed by tributes, from the rest of the Greek states. The Athenians in particular, who had been defeated in battle by the Minoans, were sending young men and women to be devoured by this sad product of incest that lived and had a voracious appetite in Crete. And these tributes maintained the capacity of the king of Crete, of Minos, to retain the peace that was necessary for trade to continue. This is my metaphor for what has been happening since 1970s. Because in 1971, when what I called before the global plan collapsed, what was the global plan? The United States of America exited the war as the only creditor nation with surpluses, massive surpluses, in the midst of the ashes that had been generated by the Second World War. And it was recycling those surpluses, both to Japan and to Western Europe, in order to ensure that these surpluses would be maintained, because without demand from Asia and from Europe for American products, the American economy was heading for another 1929. Now, this global plan, which had America as the surplus recycling mechanism of the world at its center, collapsed towards the end of the 1960s simply because the United States lost its surpluses. And then this new amazing global economy emerged where the United States again stayed at the center of this recycling of the world's surpluses, only the world's surpluses were not American anymore. America had deficits, but it was mediating so that it was working effectively like a grand vacuum cleaner, sucking up the commodities that the German, Japanese, later on the Chinese industries were churning out. And in return, the German, Japanese, and Chinese companies generated profits, which ended up in Wall Street, and therefore the world surpluses were being recycled via Wall Street. That tsunami of capital, something between $3 and $5 billion net a day, was rushing into the United States, allowing this recycling to continue. These are the tributes that were being paid to the new global minotaur, which is my metaphor for the twin deficits in the United States.
Yanis, that was a triumphant distillation of your metaphor, deriving, of course, from the Cretan myth. Let me reintroduce my guest, Yanis Varoufakis, Director of Political Economy Division at the University of Athens, right in the eye of a storm at the moment. Jeff Madrick, the editor of Challenge magazine and visiting professor of humanities at the Cooper Union. His latest book, of course, is On Greed. And Dr. Oliver Hartwich, who's a research fellow at the Centre for Independent Studies, who's talking to us from Sydney. Jeff, many pundits describe the crisis as an extraordinary event that could not have been predicted, but others feel, and you feel, that the crisis of 2008 could easily have been predicted because of the acts of certain individuals going back to the 70s. Would you bring us up to speed with this?
I should also respond to your former guests. proposition. I think it's I'm wary of metaphors. In fact, I wrote a book devoid of metaphors and chock full of details, the way I believe history has happened. I only wish America were clever enough to have a grand plan. The fact is that vacuum cleaner, which was derogatorily described, allowed the rest of the world to develop since the 1970s. We bought the goods, much as Germany is now allowed to brag about a strong economy only because the rest of Europe buys its goods. I should also point out that the argument that our trade surpluses were so important to the U.S. economy just doesn't add up. Trade was a small part of the U.S. economy in the 1950s and 60s, and we did descend into trade deficits. When we start putting details to the metaphor, I believe, and I hope it's okay for me to disagree with you.
Absolutely. But we always have civilized disagreements on this program, and I'll give Yanis a right to reply in short order. But Jeff, let's go back to this notion of the individual's role since the 70s.
Yes, indeed. The individual's roles. Individuals, you know, there's an old line in America, goes back to history, to Emerson. History is biography, or vice versa, perhaps. But in any case, I tell the story of the financialization of America. Age of Greed describes the age, but it's the financialization of America in terms of these individuals. And what it basically did was break down the Washington oversight that we developed in the 1930s. That was the great game changer, development of regulations in the 1930s that allowed us to watch over what your other guests called the perennial and consistent existence of greed. My argument is quite simple. When Washington stopped looking and participated in an ideology, a laissez-faire ideology, which is a very important part of this subject, and an anti-government ideological shift in America whose sources were pretty complex. When Washington stopped looking at Wall Street turned self-interest into outright greed. We had some extraordinary decades of dishonesty. The 1990s led the way of unenforced regulation. And it very much, and I do want to make this point clear because we have lots of guests who have lots to say, it very much resulted in a financial community challenging our precious capital, our precious savings, into areas that were unproductive, into their own areas of speculation. Fantasy high technology stocks in the late 1990s. And of course, the housing, the crazy housing boom of the 2000s, on which they made fortunes, but America did not.
I'm going to bring Oliver into the discussion again, Oliver. You're somewhere, I think, between Jeff and Yanis, but you divide the root causes of the financial crisis into two. A monetary system that favoured the creation of vast amounts of debt, and Western governments regularly spending more than they earn, particularly on redistribution through the welfare state. Your turn.
Well, if I may, I would like to bring another metaphor here.
And that's I don't know about that.
Well, it's the metaphor of the anchor. I think the world has really lost its anchor. And I would actually locate the anchor that was lost in 1971. And I would agree with Yanis on this point, that really we lost the anchor in 1971. But I would actually locate the anchor somewhere else, not where Yanis had seen it. I think 1971 was the year when the world finally moved away from the last remnants of the gold standard. Remember, that was the year when President Nixon declared that he moved away from gold, that he was no longer willing to keep up the link between the US dollar and American gold reserves, because he had to move away from that old gold standard in order to finance the Vietnam War. And ever since, we haven't had an anchor of the monetary system anywhere in the real world. From 1971 onwards, basically central banks in the Western world could print as much money as they wanted to, and they did. And they flooded the markets with enormous amounts of liquidity, of cash, and they invited market participants to play with these enormous amounts of money. And I think that is really one of the root causes of the GFC, and it was quite clearly on display in the decades that followed. We had seen numerous crises, financial crises. We had seen them in Mexico, in Asia, in Russia, and then in the GFC, of course. So that was one cause. And the other cause is, of course, that Western governments were regularly spending more than they earned. And if you want to see what happens when you let that happen, well, just look at Greece. Greece currently has a debt-to-GDP ratio of more than 140%. So basically, the country is bankrupt and it will never be able to repay its debt. So I think if we take these two causes together, on the one hand, a monetary system without any anchor, and on the other hand, governments regularly spending more than they earn, then you basically get the basic recipe of the GFC.
Oliver, you see the need to feed the welfare state as being minotaurian in a way. It's like feeding the minotaur.
Well, I should perhaps make it clear what I mean by the welfare state. I do not only mean paying out benefits, although I think there's, of course, scope for reform. But I also mean corporate welfare. We have seen companies in the Western world receiving enormous amounts of money from governments. Just think of how much, for example, the Australian car industry still receives in subsidy. Mm. Think of what happened in America, of course, with the restructuring there of their car industry, of the financial sector. Think of the billions spent on AIG, on Hypo Real Estate in Germany. Think of the involvement of the British taxpayer in the British banking system that was part nationalized in 2008. I think if you take all of this together, you can really see that Western governments have really spent too much and they have gone way beyond their capacities.
This is Late Night Live on ABC Radio, National Radio Australia, and our various electronic platforms. My guests are Jeff Madrick, Yiannis Varoufakis, and Dr. Oliver Hartwich. As promised, Yiannis, a right of reply. Would you like to talk about Jeff's response to your splendid metaphor?
I always like to talk, Philip. okay, let's start with the proposition that what brought us down was irrepressible greed that ran riot in the 1970s and 80s. I agree with that. But come to think of this, you can blame 2008 and everything that has befallen us in the last two or three years on a multitude of things that are completely and utterly related with one another. You can say that the bankers went mad printing private money, toxic money, which is true, that central banks were playing fast and loose with monetary policy, that governments were overborrowing, the welfare state was becoming increasingly weighty. You can talk about the boisterousness of the real estate sector in countries like Ireland, in Spain, of course, in the United States and Australia, about regulators falling asleep and being captured by the people that were supposed to be regulated by them, about us economists finding success with models that were increasingly distanced from reality. All this is true. But I just don't believe that what has happened is that the character of individuals has changed to become more greedy. Take that expression, greed is good. Well, it's the central argument in Adam Smith. Effectively, that you know that greed is a fantastic force for progress as long as it's regulated by competition. So none of that is news. But something happened in the 70s, and I agree that in the 70s all these phenomena took off and created the circumstances of 2008. I think that when we got out of the Second World War, the United States was being ruled by the New Dealers. The New Dealers had experienced it in their hearts and in their flesh. They had experienced the 1929 disaster. They were men that had been through that ordeal and they were determined not to see it happen again. And this is why they instituted a global plan, Bretton Woods, the Marshall Plan, a number of projects whose purpose was to take American surpluses and recycle them internationally in order to support the dollar area and to make sure that another 1929 would not happen. Because what was it that 1929 taught them? It taught them that if you have a common currency, which is necessary in order to facilitate international trade, and you have a crisis of the sort that happens in capitalism, a debt crisis, a banking crisis, whatever, that this system is going to collapse if you have a common currency without a recycling mechanism. They put that recycling mechanism in place, it broke down in 71, and then the amazing thing is that the United States of America, I'll just quote what something Paul Volcker said just before he took over the Fed in the 1970s, he said that it was in the national interest of the United States of America to effect a controlled disintegration of the world economy. The purpose of that was to attract to the United States a tsunami of capital from those who had the surpluses. This was not didn't happen accidentally. That tsunami of capital created the circumstances for financialization, and that financialization drive is what gave turbocharged boost to greed, and greed became good in a way that Mrs. Thatcher and Mr. Reagan turned into an ideology.
Back to you, Oliver. One of the things that you've written is that we're talking about a state of economics in the pre-crisis years where it was hard not to feel a sense of complacency. The Great Depression had become a distant memory, and the experience that seemed to have been gained from handling the minor economic setbacks, such as the 87 stock market crash or the Asian financial crisis, the end of the dot-com boom, seemed to demonstrate that economists and policymakers had acquired the necessary knowledge to deal with such challenges.
That's correct. I studied economics in the 1990s, and I must say I was quite disheartened by the studies of that I had, because I found them completely unrealistic. I still remember my economic growth classes when they were trying to explain to us with three variables how economic growth really works. And I was sitting there and I thought, well, if it was that simple, why did the Soviet Union fail? Didn't they have good mathematicians who could have calculated that? So I think economics really lost out on quite a number of things. They lost out on a sense of history. They didn't even know the history of their own subject. They didn't know too much about methodology. And they thought that with a few simple equations and a few models, they could actually create stability and create prosperity and growth. And I think that was a mistake, a clear mistake. And economics should have understood some history. They should have learned the history lessons. And just going back through economic history, you can see that there were crises, financial crises before, and you could have learned your lessons. But economics had become complacent. And I think we really have to think again now, after 2008 in the economics profession, how we want to teach economics in the future.
Jeff, let's go back to you. The first thing you need to know about the cycle of financial overreach, you write, crisis bailout, is that it wasn't always thus, that your country emerged from the Great Depression with a tightly regulated financial sector, and it was good enough for 40 years.
Yeah, indeed. I think there's what I would call, ironically, a historical myopia here. I mean, it seems to me this discussion is reacting to what's happened in the last couple of years and ignored the gigantic strides after World War II that were made in standards of living in the very countries in which we do, all three of us, I believe. Is the gentleman a Greek? I'm sure. In any case, the great strides that were made, this discussion is completely, from my point of view, out of historical context. As for government spending too much, again, remarkably out of historical context. The U.S. The U.S. problem is that it hasn't taxed enough. Not that it spends too much. Ronald Reagan cut taxes sharply in the early 80s, and we began to have deficits ever after. We don't have to have deficits. We would do very well by taxing ourselves somewhat more. The European countries...
Jeff, talking blasphemy, Jeff. You're talking blasphemy. The Tea Party will get you.
Yeah, the Tea Party has already come after me, and I'm proud of it, but I would like some of those German conservative economists to come after me also, because they are remarkably historically myopic and may well bring Europe down. But let's keep in mind, Greece did overspend and did overborrow, but many of the countries in trouble were running surpluses or close to balance in this period and are now in trouble because of the private markets. and the private markets were allowed to run amok. I do believe the achievements of the 40s and 50s and 60s were exactly the consequence of a rise in the, and a growth in the use of intelligent government. I do not think government is always intelligent. Government began to abandon that, what I talk about in the book in great detail, in the 1970s, and it gave rise to self-interest. And Adam Smith did not, I don't even think he used the word greed. He used the word self, but he was talking about self-interest. There's a distinction between self-interest and greed, greed resulting in the end of a kind of rule of law. That happened in the U.S. financial community, and people should be very clear about it. There are lots of details that need to be put together, and a more serious grounding of the actual history of the U.S. before we draw these very general and sweeping conclusions about what.
Back to you, Yanis. You're currently in Dublin, but of course you operate in Athens. How is what our discussion applicable to the crisis in Greece? I have to ask you that.
Oh, yes, of course. You can't avoid asking that. Look, I think that Greece is a miniaturized version of the troubles of the Eurozone. And in a sense, the troubles of the Eurozone are a small miniature of the troubles of the global economy. And what are these troubles? It's very easy to concentrate on debt because Greece is laboring under a mountain of it. And now we hear that the United States is having a mountain of debt to deal with too, so does Japan and so on and so forth. But this is just half of the story. The other half of the story is that the world is replete with a glut of savings. The problem that the global economy has is that these two are not recycled into one another. We heard about the achievements of the 1950s and the 1960s, and this is absolutely correct. These two decades was the golden era of our times. But what was it that allowed those achievements to go ahead? It was what I call a surplus recycling mechanism, a well-ordered, well-designed, it was not accidental, it didn't happen as a result of the spontaneous forces of the markets, mechanism by which the surpluses were being utilized across the world and across different sectors and invested into productive activity. That broke down in 1971, and instead we had this unbalanced growth, which was maintained by what I call the minotaur. If you don't like the metaphor, you can use another one. That broke down in 2008. And now we have this glut of savings on the one hand and these mountains of debt on the other hand. In Europe in particular, we have a common currency without any means by which the surpluses are taken from where they are being produced and invested in productive activity in the deficit areas. And this is the reason why the Eurozone is going to collapse, because as we found out in 1929, the first thing that goes, if you don't have the surplus recycling mechanism, is a common currency. The common currency in 1929 was the gold standard. The common currency in Europe now is, of course, the euro. But the way we're going, because we are denying that there is a problem of recycling, will mean that the Eurozone is probably going to be history before too long, unless, of course, Germany and the rest of the surplus countries decide to see the world through the prism which is reminiscent of that of the New Dealers of the 1940s.
Oliver.
I don't quite agree with this, because I think the Eurozone is also an example of economics ignoring history lessons. Because the current European Monetary Union is, of course, not the first time that Europe tried to have a common currency. There was a predecessor. The predecessor was the Latin Monetary Union. It was founded in 1867 by the French, and at its peak, it united 18 European countries under one currency effectively, and that was the French franc, and the other currencies were linked to that. Now, that Latin Monetary Union failed. It eventually failed in 1927, but actually in 1908, Greece was kicked out of that union because the Greek government at that time had fiddled with its figures and it had unfortunately not played by the rules set by the monetary union. So in a way, all of these symptoms that we are seeing today were already present about a century earlier. The Latin Monetary Union was suffering from exactly the same kinds of problems. The countries were too different. There were no rules that were enforced. The countries were not playing by any of the rules. There was no central authority making monetary union work. And if you're looking at the euro today, I think you're seeing exactly the same kinds of problems. You're seeing that you have countries that are too different. You have different inflation rates. You have different productivities. You have different histories and different cultures, and you're trying to unite them all under one currency, and that doesn't work.
Back to you, Jeff, and I'd like to now introduce a specific example of an individual who gets swept up in the greed culture. And you focus on Walter Wriston, head of what would become Citicorp. Why Wriston?
Well, Wriston was the head of, in the 1960s, of First National Citibank, later to become Citicorp. His father was an extreme anti-New Dealer, hated regulations. His father was a prominent scholar. And Wriston found himself in business, much to his own surprise. But he was an ambitious, intelligent man. And he began to break down one regulation. And he aggressively recycled OPEC oil money in the 1970s. A government had something to do with that, but in the end, he acted far sooner than government could to start to try to stabilize and those debt flows. Wriston made a fortune, and Wriston's bank made a fortune lending money, in particular to South America, but also to nations. He broke down Regulation Q, which began to, which enabled him to raise money, and what economists like Henry Kaufman and Al Wojnarowski called spread banking. Interest rates might go up, but Wriston could keep raising money. It's something economists kept ignoring in the 1970s. It was a major cause of the inflation in those days. Before this, if you raised interest rates, it cut lending and so on. He, in many ways, was the pioneer of deregulation. Irony, he preached laissez-faire vociferously everywhere he went. And yet his bank was bailed out three times by the government in the course of his tenure. In those times, of course, the exception, he claimed that there was an exception to these laissez-faire rules. I would like to say about recycling, John Maynard Keynes, of course, at the Bretton Woods Agreement, which Janos, I think, is talking about, wanted a specific system of recycling surpluses and deficits. It was not established. The dollar became, in effect, the gold standard, period. And the dollar, and it was starting to fail because we did not have a system for recycling. Even back then, it didn't all collapse in 1971 in wage and price and going off gold. But I do agree entirely that we should have tried to develop a new system to manage deficits and surpluses, and I think Europe should as well. And I know you think you want me to stick to the question you answered, but I do feel obliged to answer some of these. And let me remind you of one monetary union that did work. By the way, many economists in America don't think monetary unions work, so maybe it isn't all that bad. In light of Oliver's statement. But one monetary union that did work was the United States of America. So it is possible.
Okay, I've got to move it on because we're running out of time and there's a lot of ground to cover. Eunice, most of the characters in Jeff's book are the capitalists who were responsible for what we're seeing today. Now, you make a really interesting point that many of the early capitalists hadn't chosen to be capitalists, just as during humanity's first great leap forward, hunter-gatherers didn't choose to become farmers, but were led to agriculture by hunger. And you extrapolate from that. They then borrowed from moneylenders to pay for seeds. The moneylenders, in turn, became bankers. Talk to that.
Well, I think this is a pivotal moment in world history. Under feudalism, we had a very simple sequence in the production phase. First, you had production. The peasants worked effectively. They produced a harvest. Mm. And then the second phase was the distribution phase. The sheriff would come in and collect the lord's cut. And then then you would have financialization, because the Lord's cut would then be sold in rudimentary market, and the Lord would get money from that, which then the Lord would lend or use in various ways. With the enclosures, with the eviction of the peasantry from the lands, especially in England and in Wales and partly in Scotland, what you have is a situation where suddenly the land becomes a commodity to be traded, to be rented, and some of those ex-peasants, or perhaps a sheriff, is forced by circumstances to borrow money in order to rent the land from the landlord, to take some of the ex-peasants and bring them back on the land as wage laborers. So what happens is, before the production starts or before the harvest comes in, there has to be borrowing and payment to suppliers, to wage laborers. So the distribution phase comes before the production phase. So there's a reversal in the sequence. And this reversal is important, firstly because it unleashes a lot of productive capacity, so the economy becomes a lot more productive, at least on average. And secondly, and more importantly, because it introduces financialization right even before the distribution, the distributional process, because money needs to be borrowed. It is as if society, with the advent of capitalism, is taking its long arm, it's pushing it into the future, dragging value that has not been produced yet, bringing it to the present in order to motivate productive resources to produce the present value in the future. And this is credit, of course. And this is very important, but at the same time, the people who were responsible for that credit, or are the heart of that process, the bankers, acquire a significant new social power over everybody else. And this is the process that starts the major crisis, because sometimes this hand, steered by the bankers, overreaches, takes too much value, attempts to take too much value from the future and bring it to the present. The result is a bubble. Periodic collapses, and the bankers have to be bailed out because they are such an instrumental part of this process.
Okay, back to you, Oliver. Here's this arching historical overview from Yiannis. Is it should we be refraining from delivering a premature judgment on the face of capitalism and the face of current crises? It's only safe to say that we are witnessing an economic crisis, says you, which will hopefully come to an end soon.
Well, first of all, I would say that what we are seeing is not the kind of capitalism that, for example, Adam Smith or Friedrich Hayek or Ludwig von Mises advocated. What we are seeing is really a crony kind of capitalism, a sick capitalism, a capitalism that is captured by particular interests, by lobby groups, by bankers. It's not the kind of capitalism that I advocate at all. What I would like to see is a capitalism where, for example, you need to save first before you can actually use that and for investment. It's a kind of capitalism where you actually bear your own risks, the risks of your investment decisions, where you can't bank on somebody else bailing you out if things go pear-shaped. That's the kind of capitalism that I would like to see. That's the kind of capitalism that economists since Adam Smith have advocated. It's a capitalism that needs rules. It's a capitalism that needs contract law, for example, that needs competition law, that needs an independent judiciary, that needs proper institutions. It's not a free-for-all capitalism. It's a capitalism that actually needs a strong state to enforce the rules. So I think we should first get it clear what we really mean when we are talking about capitalism. I believe what we have seen since the 1970s was a really, degenerated form of capitalism. It's not the kind of market economy that I would like to see. Unfortunately, we are seeing this game played on now with the Eurozone, where it's now, of course, extremely attractive to invest in some of the periphery countries because they're giving you such great yields. But you're only doing it, of course, because you know that if things really go wrong, you can be bailed out by another government. So yeah, that's not the kind of capitalism that I would like to see.
Jeff, back to you, and I want to look at another of the individuals you write about. Tell us about Sam Walton, whose success was partly built on the troubled economy of the 70s.
Well, yeah, of course, Sam Walton built Walmart. He was a remarkable businessman and entrepreneur. And, speaking of greed, made Silas Marner look like a spendthrift. He was from the very beginning, he was trying to pay wages to his employees that were below the minimum legal standard. This is not to take away from his achievements as a businessman or to take away that much. He was brilliant. He invented the discount store. But in the process, he developed a model, one of the many sub-models of capitalism that Oliver is referring to. And I precisely what he's referring to about this capitalism without rules is what my book, Age of Greed, is about. But Walton developed a model which depended on very low wage rates and keeping low wage rates down, minimizing the jobs done, and frankly, eventually abuse, because while there was a lack of, at the end of the rule of law in finance, there was little rule of law in the labor markets. Now, some people, maybe even on this phone call, may think we shouldn't have any minimum wage laws at all. I'm not sure. But those labor laws were abused. So Walton became the richest man in America for a while. He created this mammoth retail operation. Eventually, it became very dependent on imports from China for those cheap goods. But it was mostly dependent on very cheap labor. He famously paid no health insurance, and in the end, when you make the computations, depended on Medicaid to supplement the health insurance that his workers had.
Jeff, did President Carter think through the consequences of appointing Volcker, Paul Volcker, as the Federal Reserve chief?
You know, Carter was a complex and man who was not ready to be president at a very difficult time to be president in the U.S. People keep talking about President Obama's agenda and the difficulties. I think the agenda Carter faced was even more difficult. But Carter was basically a fiscal conservative. He disliked budget deficits and he disliked inflation. And when Paul Volcker came and said, I'm going to try to stop inflation, I don't think Carter fully believed he would go the full route that he went, which was ultimately to raise interest rates to 17-18%. So no, I don't think he quite understood what he was up to. His main economists urged him not to do it. His close friend allies urged him not to do it. But the rest is history.
Okay, of course, Clinton played the game and made matters rather worse, Jeff, did he not, with Benson and then Robert Rubin?
Well, I think he made matters worse. I mean, I was pleased. I think his great achievement was being able to raise income tax rates on higher-income people in that period. So, you know, there's a good and a bad Clinton here. But eventually, with Rubin, Benson, then Rubin, then Larry Summers, the Democrats indeed aggressively favored deregulatory attitudes.
Well, that's because they knew that Wall Street was a place to get campaign financing, didn't they?
They knew that Wall Street was a place to get campaign funds. I think that was very influential. But they also, maybe that is the whole story. I never believe in unicausal explanations. But yes, people like Larry Summers, once an avowed Keynesian from Harvard, began to preach the deregulation that Milton Friedman, by and large, popularized with his more popular books.
Let's go back to our National Geographic picture of the Minotaur, Yanis. The gruesome payments of a tribute to the Minotaur were imposed by the king's military might. It's interesting, is it not, that the tribute of capital that fed the global Minotaur flooded into the U.S. voluntarily.
Absolutely, and that's where the brilliance of Paul Volcker, whatever else we might think about him, comes in. Because he is the one that, not just with interest rate hikes of immense magnitude, but by other means, which we don't have the time to go into now, created the magneticism, which was instrumental in attracting those capital waves and flows into Wall Street, which later caused the financialization drive. But let me, I'm tempted to say something to one of our group who mentioned capitalism not being today what that which Adam Smith and Hayek and the other liberal thinkers advocated. Well, it never was. Capitalism always had as much to do with Adam Smith and Hayek as Soviet communism had to do with Marx. Absolutely nothing. What happened after these tributes to the Global Minotaur became so large that Wall Street effectively took over the money printing, because this is what the derivatives were, it was a form of private money. The world was flooded with that private money, and then in 2008 it burned down. And the result of that was that the recycling mechanism that I keep going on about, the one that maintained the very fast growth around the world until 2008, simply broke down. And the result of this is that we have a new regime now that we live under. I don't call it crony capitalism. We always had crony capitalism. We have something I call bankruptocracy. Mm. That is a regime in which the more bankrupt the banks, the greater the power that they have over the distribution of whatever wealth is left across the world.
Oliver, I think this may be the last question. You write about the result of demographic change, populations aging, even shrinking, the ability to handle debt burdens in the future is dwindling. Japan, Italy, Germany are the first countries that will experience such a demographically induced debt shock. So this crisis will continue, in your view, in a morphing or different form.
It will. I think there is no doubt about it. If we take the German example, Germany can expect over the next 40 years to see its workforce shrink by about a third. Now, Germany already has a debt-to-GDP ratio officially of more than 80%. The unofficial liabilities in Germany are way higher. We are probably talking around 400%. How are you ever going to repay any of that debt with a shrinking workforce?
How am I going to repay my debt to the three of you is now my problem as we wrap the program. But Jeff Madrick, editor of The Challenge magazine, visiting professor of humanities at the Cooper Union, I thank you. Yanis Varoufakis, director of the Political Economy Division at the University of Athens, I thank you. And you too, Dr. Oliver Hartwich from the Centre for Independent Studies. That is the program for today. Now, on our next, we're going to run something in genuine response to popular demand. People often say that, but this time it's true. We're going to bring you, once again, a history of ballet. Now, it's a wonderful, wonderful program. I found it so interesting to do. I learned so much about an art form that's got much more significance than I think any of us realised. And for more information on any of the interviews, you can visit our website on abc.net.au/rn/Late Night Live. And stick around now on ABC Radio National for the news. And as Elena Katz-Chernin takes us out, we'll see you later.